What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine.
Network programming, how does it work? Hi there, I am Ken Levine, your podcast moderator. This is part two of our two-part interview with Preston Beckman, who is a media consultant and chairman of the Beckman Group for 20 years. He was at NBC. He was at NBC during the must-see TV era, and he was putting their schedules together for them then. And for 15 years, he was at Fox. Part one was last week. If you missed it, after you listen to this week, go back and listen to that. This week, we're going to get into TV ratings, research, building a schedule, counter-programming, moving shows from one night to another, why networks have abandoned Friday and Saturday nights. We'll talk a little bit about sports on TV, post-Super Bowl programming, what makes for a good pilot. That's a fascinating section. Also, we'll talk a little bit about casting, the casting of Cheers and Seinfeld. And interestingly, George Costanza was not originally played by Jason Alexander. And on news radio, you know the Dave Foley part? Well, that was not originally Dave Foley. So a great interview coming up, part two, with Preston Beckman.
Hollywood and Levine.
Let's talk a little bit about ratings, because it's always been a pet peeve of TV producers that our lives depend on these ratings, and we're not quite sure how accurate they are.
Well, first of all, our lives depended on
yes,
it also.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Our jobs as were on the line as much as yours
That's
were.
That's true.
I think that they're pretty accurate. They're not perfect. But I think that unless Nielsen's completely making them up, and I'm not going to completely dismiss that, you know, the fact that every week you see a pretty reliable consistency in the ratings, plus or minus, you know, and there is a level of confidence around that number. I think that's telling you something. I think that if you've worked in the business as long as I have or even you have a pretty good idea what that rating is going to be for the premiere. I mean, on my Twitter feed, I will oftentimes predict the ratings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not to pat myself on, I'm pretty accurate, not because I have some kind of, just I've looked at them for so long, and when you factor in the changes in ratings where what used to be considered a disaster is now considered renewable, you know, you can get pretty close, because first of all, the range nowadays is maybe, you know, 0.9 to a 2
on
broadcast network. So how off are you going to be?
Right.
You know, so I think that they're accurate. I think Nielsen they are a monopoly, and I think that they do a really good job of keeping everybody else out of the marketplace. I mean, in all the years I've been, whether in research or in programming, I don't know how many competitors to Nielsen have come and gone and will continue to come and go, so they seem to still have that monopoly. So I do believe that in the ratings, and even in a show like Cheers, even though it started small, I mean, clearly we saw growth and we saw continued growth. And it's also the other thing about ratings is the demographics. And You rarely see a show that doesn't in some way conform to what you believe the demos of that show are going to look like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, again, as a producer, I always felt that you can take the ratings and you can skew them any way you want. You know, you could say, hey, but look at it. We went up 36% in women 18 to 19.
Well, that's the job of our press department. Right. I mean, you know, everybody's a winner.
We're doing good.
Yeah, but I will say, I mean, in all the years that I was in scheduling, I mean, there were so many shows that if you purely looked at the ratings would have been canceled. Seinfeld was a classic example. Cheers at the beginning. Homicide. Mm-hmm. Which went on for about 5 or 6 years on the network. I'll Fly Away, which we gave a second season to. There were lots of, I can give you lots of examples of shows that Arrested Development over at Fox, where Rupert Murdoch almost threw me out of a window when I stood up there and said, we're bringing it back for a second season. So, I mean, I know the broadcast executive is painted in some kind of evil suit, uh-huh. you know, soulless
What did they hate about Arrested Development? I mean, it won the Emmy that
but
first
year. But its ratings were, and again, you know, to your point about Fox, there was no natural place on our network for a show like
right. Well, it was a family show.
Yeah, right.
When you put the schedule together, mm-hmm. are you concentrating more on just your needs and your network, yeah. or are you focusing a lot on counter-programming?
Well, I did it for almost 25 years. So, you know, if I told you that the way I did it in 1991 was the way I was doing it.
Right, and that's mid, you know, changing now.
I would be lying to you.
Sure.
I mean, I think when I started, there was much more, as I said, of the zero-sum game. You had to be much more aware of what was your competition was going to be. You had to anticipate it because when you were in the scheduling room, sometimes you didn't know exactly what your competition was going to be.
Right.
As we started to become successful at NBC, I found that I cared less about what the other guys were doing because I felt we just had a strong enough schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
they had to counter-program you.
Yeah, also what we did at one point, and I can't remember if somebody changed, there was a certain order in which the networks announced their schedules.
Right.
And NBC, I believe, was going last.
Uh-huh.
And then
is what you want, right?
No.
Oh, I would think that first would be the worst.
You want to go first.
Oh.
If you have a strong schedule, you want to be first.
Okay.
So my point being is that I convinced my boss, Warren Littlefield, that we should jump over the other networks and take Monday, because I believe we were going on Thursday or something. We were going after.
Do you guys agree to it, or how does that even work?
Nobody was going on Monday.
Oh, I see.
So we
okay.
That was a great expense to all of us because that we usually would go to New York over Mother's Day weekend. So a lot of us had to convince our spouses that we're going to be in New York for Mother's
uh-huh.
Day, and that's the way we. So we would always go first. And I believe when I got to Fox, we moved to first also once we had America. I like it because as a scheduler, even though there are very smart people in all scheduling jobs now, I always the golden rule for me was let the other guys or women, but unfortunately it was mostly guys back then, do the dirty work for you.
Uh-huh.
You know, you put your schedule out and you let them react. And they'll generally react in ways to make you stronger and them weaker. They might not realize it, but that's what they do. So I always believed in going first.
And sometimes counter-programming is a big risk, and you mm-hmm. really lead with your chin. I remember, and I imagine this was your time at NBC, but I was on Frasier. And NBC moved us from Thursday to Tuesday. Mm-hmm. This was not
was
a popular... That was you?
That was me.
Okay. You were not a popular figure in the Frasier room,
yes.
although it did work out.
Yes.
Yeah.
if you have a minute, I'll tell you. Basically, we had some unscripted programming. We were thinking of putting some unscripted programming on Tuesday, and I got a call from one of the veteran sales executives in New York who told me that if I come to New York with a schedule with Unsolved Mysteries on Tuesday night, she was going to kill me. And I believed her. I believed her. So I was, back then, that schedule would be in my mind 24/7.
Right.
And on a Friday night, Saturday morning, I suddenly had an epiphany. And I said, well, we've got these four really good shows on Thursday night. What if we doubled down? What if we took two of the shows over to Tuesday and put one at 8 and one at 9? And again, back then, flow mattered.
Right.
And we suddenly find ourselves with four slots to put new comedies, which would cost a lot less, and it would give us four opportunities to find a new hit.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, this is before Excel, I took a piece of paper and I wrote this all down, mm-hmm. and I faxed it to Warren Littlefield on Saturday morning, and he called me up because I didn't realize it. I was just thinking about the shows and not the studios, and uh-huh. I realized that the two shows we moved over to Tuesday were both from Paramount.
Uh-huh.
And Warren called me and he said, you know, I think we have to do this, but we're going to have to find somebody to start our cars for a few weeks. Because we knew what was going to happen.
Right.
And I actually ran into Kelsey Grammer at our, I think it was at our affiliate convention.
Okay.
And I introduced myself, and he kind of knew who I was, because I think I was kind of a pariah. and I told him the same thing I told Gary Hart, who was running the studio at the time, Paramount. And I said to Kelsey, I said, look, if you're at some point, there'll be enough episodes of Frasier to go into syndication. And if you're the show that followed Seinfeld for your whole career, that means a lot less. That gives you a lot. There's a lot less value in that than being the show that started a second night for NBC.
Uh huh.
And I said, if Paramount can't
spin, yeah.
No, it's true.
It's true. I know. Yeah.
And I said to him, if Paramount can't figure that out, I will personally write the sales presentation for this show, because if this works, you've added tremendous value to the show.
And it did.
And it did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So thank you.
You're welcome.
In retrospect. Oh, yeah. I remember at the time.
It was scary. It was a scary thing to do, and there was a lot of debate inside the building about doing that. And if you remember, ABC moved. We were going up against Roseanne.
Okay.
Frasier was going up against Roseanne,
right.
And ABC moved Home Improvement to Tuesday at 9 o'clock to counter the move. And again, remember what I said about let the other guys do the dirty work for you. You know, by doing that, ABC probably hurt themselves more than mm-hmm. it affected Frasier.
You know, it always baffles me that there is not another show like Frasier, that mm-hmm. none of the networks are developing a smart, sophisticated show like Frasier, when Frasier proved that it can draw a very large audience.
Right. And when they do, they go back to shows like Will and Grace. In other words, they go back to a show
right.
rather than saying, I first of all, you know, there aren't as many comedies on as there used to. You know, I think CBS has a certain formula, even though CBS has a couple of smart comedies in Mom,
mm-hmm.
And even Big Bang in its own way. And ABC has its formula. And ABC tried a couple of non-family shows. They didn't work.
Right.
I think NBC's trying to do some mm-hmm. shows like that. But, you know, again, it's a different world now.
Is the reboots, you know, smack of desperation to a certain extent?
I think it's what it is, you know, how do you break through everything? And clearly if you reboot Roseanne or you reboot Will and Grace, you're going to get the ink or this whatever we
right.
call it
right.
nowadays.
But like the Will and Grace numbers are
yes.
like going down,
yeah,
going steadily
night,
down.
Last night it was down to a one rating.
Yeah,
so,
so it's like, well, it's a novelty.
Yes.
But after a few weeks, you go, well, I can watch the reruns and they're younger and funnier.
Right. Same thing with X-Files,
uh-huh.
where, you know, it came back very low this time around.
So. Really? All the aliens in the world watch that show, though.
Okay.
The largest audience is usually Sunday and Monday night. Friday and Saturday used to be big nights on television, and now in terms of the broadcast networks, they're almost abandoned, right, aren't they?
Yeah, I think about that a lot because, you know, it's kind of, in a way, it's silly because when the talk is that there are all these ways in which we're going to monetize these shows and make profit off of these shows, and advertising is becoming less and less a factor mm-hmm. in that, mm-hmm. well, why don't you take full advantage of your 22 or 15 hours of television? Why don't you program sure. Saturday night with comedies or dramas? And yeah, maybe they get, by the way, during the week, a lot of these shows are getting 0.91 ratings.
Right.
There's no reason why, you know, a older, by older, I mean 25, 54, skewing procedural on Saturday night, or three procedurals right. on Saturday night, won't get a one rating.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you build up episodes, and then you have all these other platforms in which you can. So I kind of, when I left in 2015, the last time I was in a scheduling room, I made this case that your schedule is kind of like your homepage. And you have to look at it as a homepage as opposed to a schedule. And if you have 15 hours that you can program, you have 15 hours where you can create assets for the corporation.
And, great way of putting it.
And there's this notion of seeing, because the usage levels are somewhat lower on Saturday and somewhat lower on Friday, because some of it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because, you know, you remember the days of the Golden Girls
yeah.
and the CBS Sunday night.
Yeah, Mary even, Tyler Moore and All in the Family and right. MASH, they were all on Saturday
night. Right, one of the biggest battles was Dallas versus Miami Vice on Friday night.
Right,
you know, so,
right.
So there were so many. ABC had its Fantasy Island, Love Boat, T.J. Hooker. I mean, there were some classic Saturday and Friday night blocks of programming.
Right, Carol and, Burnett and all yeah, that. Yeah.
And some of it was, I think, you know, cable started to make inroads on those nights. That's where HBO started to put its, on Saturday night, put its original movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the networks kind of rolled over quickly and just sort of gave up and said, oh, well. And then also, I think nowadays with sports, all the networks – a little less so CBS, but all the networks look at Saturday night as a way to help monetize their sports packages.
Right.
So you see more and more of that taking place also. But I agree with you.
I have always contended that for a major broadcast network, mm-hmm. whatever it costs, you need to have the NFL.
I agree with that.
Yeah, you know,
you need the NFL or something big. You need whether
right.
it's the NFL, the Major League Baseball in the sense of the World Series can still we've seen the last few years.
Right.
The NCAA tournament is I think is a big.
It's right.
It also helps CBS in that it covers a couple of Thursday and Friday nights where they can spread out their original programming more and they do a few less repeats, but. But, yeah, I mean, you know, the NFL, NBC now will sometimes do two games
right.
a week. But before the Thursday night package and when football was on ESPN when it was on Monday night on ABC, that Sunday night overrun would generally make the difference as far as what network won the whole week.
Right. And I remember when CBS lost football
yeah.
to Fox
yeah. –
their network went right into the tank.
I've always believed the sports audience is a borrowed audience. I don't think a lot of them hang around for whatever follows. There's a little bit of that on Fox, given that it's a young 18,
right.
34 male audience. But
right.
football really is older. I don't even know if it's really a promotional platform. I honestly don't. I think it's really just being a ratings whore. I think it's
uh-huh.
really just wanting those huge numbers that you get from, and every once in a while there's a perfect storm on CBS or on Fox where you get both the NFC or the AFC championship game and the Super Bowl on
right.
your network
right.
on the same year. And it's
right.
like that's all it takes to win the season. on those, those two nights.
Right.
So, oh yeah, it's, and also from a schedule's point of view, it's kind of like a win-win because you also, there's no pressure on you that night.
Right.
The only pressure with the Super Bowl is what to put on after it. Mm-hmm. And when I was at NBC, you know, every year everybody would go, okay, we're going to launch a show after the Super Bowl.
Right.
And with the exception of, I can't even say one of the years, because the one of the years was going to go after Roseanne. And the A-Team, which started, which didn't start at premiere a week earlier to a huge rating, it suddenly dawned on me, this isn't working. That you're not really launching shows after the Super Bowl. So one year I pitched the idea of, why don't we take one of our biggest shows and go to them and ask them to do a special episode after the Super Bowl. And we went, first we went to Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry turned us down, which didn't shock me at all. So we went to Friends.
Yeah, Friends.
Yeah,
right.
And they did a one-hour episode, and we announced it in the upfront, which was the most important point of it. And we made a lot of money. And that started a trend, not just at NBC, but with other networks, of going a little bit away from trying to launch something and saying, how can we make a lot of money after the Super Bowl? And it also, not only did we make a lot of money, but it helped the Super Bowl ratings, because the post-game show had its one of its highest ratings ever in 18 to 49 viewers, because people were waiting for Friends to come on.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a lot.
Final question. I want to talk a little bit about program research.
Okay.
Because when it seems like 90%, whatever the percentage is, of shows that fail.
Yeah.
And all of them tested well, or tested well enough to get on the air, and shows like Seinfeld tested horribly, isn't it a kind of faulty method of making your decisions?
Well, first of all, Seinfeld didn't test as horribly as legend has it.
Okay. Just it, tested really, really bad.
Yeah, I mean, most shows...
Too many Jews.
You know, most shows, back at NBC, we used to have strong, moderate, and weak were the three categories.
Okay.
And then within each of those categories, there was a strong, weak, moderate, weak, weak. and Seinfeld, I believe, was either a weak, moderate, or a strong, weak. It was somewhere there, so it wasn't at the bottom of the barrel.
Right.
And I'll answer your question in a second. But one year we were at NBC, we were part of General Electric, and we had these I call them the GE nerds, who would show up in my office every once in a while, since I had the background in research, and they would say, what can we do for you? We want to do something. And Eric Cardinal was our head of research. And when we asked, one of the things they did for us was they redid our evaluation of pilots based on the testing. And based on their model, both Friends and Seinfeld were stronger shows than the testing indicated in the way we were evaluating the shows.
Okay.
They weren't through the roof.
Right.
But to answer your question, you know, there, if you you can think of shows there are weak testing shows. There are very few really weak testing shows. I mean, bad testing shows that succeed.
Okay.
There are a lot of strong testing shows that fail. I'm not. I'll give you that.
Okay.
But if you get and by the way, in at both NBC and especially at Fox, we put a lot of really bad testing shows on the air and they failed.
Mm-hmm.
They failed. So, you know, if it's rejected in the testing, it's rejected. The issue is, do you have a good pilot that a smart creator did who knows how to do a good pilot, or do you have a television show? They're different.
Right. Right.
You know,
yes.
There is, I don't have to tell
yes.
you.
Uh-huh.
There are a bunch of rules that if you say, I want to make a pilot and I want to get it on the air, here are the rules I will follow.
Right, right.
And then you get...
Tank goes through a wall
grandfathers,
in the first 5 seconds.
Grandfathers, a dog peeing on the villain.
Right, yeah, exactly. you know, hot babes
yeah,
and everything.
I used to call it the wait moment in a pilot, especially comedies, where people come together. They haven't known each other, or whatever. They come, and even happened with Cheers, actually. They come together, and then they're about to break up or leave. Uh-huh. And somebody goes, wait. You uh-huh. know?
Right.
You've seen that. Some version of that.
Yes.
I would always tell
We've
people.
We've done a version of that.
Oh, of course. I mean, it's like, it's TV 101. And I would always tell people, be very wary of that.
Uh-huh.
It'll work once in a while.
Uh-huh.
Because you don't know what the show is.
Right.
All you know is the setup. You don't know right. the show. Friends, on the other hand, if you remember that first episode, five of them are hanging out in the coffee shop, and Rachel comes walking in a wedding dress. So they're already friends.
Right.
That's why family comedies generally, what you see is what you get. Because, okay, here's the family. They know each other. They love each other. They care about each other. Oh, and they gave us a very satisfying episode. So to me, I call it the phenomenon. I call it people together versus people apart. If you get a pilot, especially sitcoms, where the people were apart and come together at the end, watch out. If you get a pilot where the people are together, you know what you're going to get. So there are a lot of tricks. So therefore, you know, especially with high testing shows, you'll sometimes find that you've been snookered. And I remember towards the end of my career at Fox, we had a very high testing pilot comedy, and the head of research said, "Guys, don't put this on the air."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "What? There's our highest."
Right.
It was a 30-minute movie. We've seen the end.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Yeah.
So it's not. You know. Again, the real art are those middle shows. Mad About You was not a strong testing pilot. Why? Because remember, this was back in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Having sex on a kitchen counter while your family was in the other room turned off a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
But people loved the couple. So even though the testing wasn't that good, when we looked at what the characters, they loved Paul and Jamie. So it's not just, it's never been the case in the years I've been doing it that, oh, this is your highest testing pilot, let's put it on the air. I will say that if something is really, really, really weak, you will get resistance from the developers and something. But I rarely, if ever, have I seen that show work.
Mm-hmm.
It's just been rejected.
Interesting. You bring up the point about creators and good showrunners.
Yes.
And it seems to me that is a huge value, that if you put on a show from a showrunner who you trust, then chances are he's going to be able to deliver a good show from week to week. And yet, as I sit on the sidelines now and look at the development of these networks, so many of these pilots are an actor who has a deal and a stand-up, and people who've like never written are doing these pilots. And I'm thinking to myself, you people are walking into a propeller. You have no right. idea what you are in for in how you make a television show every week. And so it always shocks me that a network is willing to take a gamble and spend all of this money on people who have no idea what they're doing.
Well, go on for another hour on that. But you know, first of all, there's just such a demand for programming that there's that.
Right.
Second of all, you say I can curse on here.
Yes, you can.
There's the star fucking element of it. It's mm-hmm. like it's the press release. It's not so much I have a show that I can put out a press release that says so and so is doing a show for me,
right.
or this star who's never done anything in television is going to produce a TV show and probably holds television in contempt.
Right.
But you're, you know,
but it's taking the money. Yeah.
Every once in a while, though, a smart television executive or network. Well, New Girl, I think, was a case where they said, we have a show here. We have an inexperienced showrunner. Let's find somebody to help. So every once in a while, you will see a network will acknowledge that, we might need someone who knows how to run a television show.
Right.
Because we think it's going to pay off for us, which it did in the case of New Girl. With all due respect to the creator of it.
Uh-huh.
So I think some of it is, you're in this business long enough, especially if you're in a scheduling job, because the scheduler has a completely different set of ways in which they're evaluated. So, you know, we all of us, and even when we get together, we'll roll our eyes a lot. And we go, what are they thinking? What, you know, the, right. And mostly it's, you know, it's, oh, we got, oh, and then there's the competent, we got them, they didn't. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you got them because they didn't want them.
Right.
You know, so, and, you know, agents know how to play the game and get the networks bidding for each other. So, yeah, I mean, it's. I think it's a question of there's just such a need for product that they're willing to go anywhere, and if they feel they've got they can get a press release out of it, maybe there'll be a show down the road. Mm-hmm. And so many of these things never happen.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Exactly. And you know, another advantage of being in the business for any length of time is that we realize, yes, as creators, as showrunners, we're valuable, but casting,
yes,
is everything.
I agree with that. I mean,
yeah.
I can think of, you know, Seinfeld originally, Larry Miller had the George Costanza role.
Uh-huh.
Ooh. And, yeah.
That's four and out.
Well, yeah. You know, and Laurie yeah. Opendon, who was head of casting at NBC, was the one who put Jason Alexander in that role. House. Gary Sinise was House.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Marcia Shulman, who was head of casting at Fox at the time, found you, Laurie.
Uh-huh.
And even Emily Deschanel and Bones. You know, there were some really, that makes it's all about casting.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, because again, if you start with a concept that's tried and true and is going to work, you know, I mean, could work,
right.
Then it's about finding the people. I think that's true with Empire.
It's a great cast.
Yeah, it's a great cast, and I think that's why the show works as much as anything. So it always comes down to, do you have the chemistry, the right people, and then do you have the writing? You know, it's writing and casting. That's it.
Right. I mean, I think back to the casting session of Ted Danson and Shelley Long,
uh-huh.
And there were basically three teams. There was Shelley and Ted, and there was William Devane, and I think Julia Duffy, and Fred Dreyer, and Lisa Eichelberger. And you just saw the couples, and it was just very clear that,
right.
that Ted and Shelley, that
oh, yeah.
that was it.
Now, by the way, once in a while you blow it.
Sure
you
do.
Know,
sure
I remember it wouldn't have made a difference, but News Radio, the original pilot, Ray Romano, was uh-huh. the Joe Rogan role.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And they dumped him. And so, you know, everyone, and, you know, and then sometimes you'll see some big, big, big stars who just, you know, in their first efforts where, you know, like Jennifer Aniston was in Ferris Bueller's Day Off mm-hmm. and Ben Affleck was in the show called Against the Grain. So every once in a while you grab onto somebody and you're right. I think James Franco, Seth Rogen, I mean, the cast of Freaks and Geeks was amazing.
A great cast, yeah.
So sometimes you're ahead of your time, sometimes you blow it and you put, you know.
You know, the planets have to line up too.
Yes.
I mean, Jennifer Aniston has to be available when
oh,
you're
yes.
casting Friends.
Well.
Which she wasn't.
She wasn't.
Actually, yeah.
Yeah, she was. Well, that's another interesting story
right.
because she was in second position, which meant she was on a CBS comedy, which was not on the fall schedule. But because the comedy hadn't been canceled, we weren't certain that she would be available for Friends. And CBS, for whatever reason, announced they were putting this comedy on a Saturday night in the summer. And I remember we were at a current meetings for your, or where we get together and talk about all the shows.
Mm-hmm.
And Warren Littlefield, my boss, turned to me and he said, "Kill it." He said, "I don't care what you have to do, kill that show." So we had a series of Danielle Steele movies, which
uh-huh.
were not scheduled.
Right.
And we had a few, we always had a few originals in the bag. And I took one or two, I know I took at least one, I think two original Danielle Steele movies.
Uh-huh.
And the first 2 weeks that the comedy was on, it was going up against original Danielle Steele movies,
right.
which not only were get ratings, but going right at that women 25,
right.
54
you
audience.
You just buried them.
And, oh, destroyed the show. I destroyed a show on, which I'm not proud, on Fox called, it was a firehouse show. And Fox did something, not going in detail, and really pissed us off.
Okay.
So I called up the head of scheduling, and I said, I can't tell you when, but I am going to retaliate. And they put on the show at the start of the summer. They were trying to do original programming in the summer, and I had a second run of Backdraft. And I called Warren, and I said to Warren, you know, I think I can kill this show, and we can retaliate if I put Backdraft on. And he said, fine, but just find out what the studio, what studio is
right,
producing
right.
the fire.
It's not the same studio.
Yeah, it's
yes,
not NBC
yeah,
Productions. Right, right. I'd be out of a job.
Right.
And anyway, it turned out it was a Fox show, and I put it on and destroyed the premiere.
Uh-huh.
Destroyed it. And I got a call from their head of scheduling saying, are you done?
Are you guys friends? You know?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, it's a very specific job.
Sure.
And the people in the job are all somewhat similar.
Uh-huh.
We're all sports fans.
Right.
We all like music, it seems, you know, and we love TV. Really, you have to love TV to do this job. And you're also, I think, and I think it's true of all of them, is none of us are, we know what our role is. We don't have personal agendas. We kind of show up and we know our role is to be the consigliere to the president, chairman, whatever the title
right,
du jour is.
Right.
And that's where they go for the honest answers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it served me well, and I think clearly it served Kelly Caldwell because he's now running CBS. It also gave me access to Rupert Murdoch, who he knew he could call me.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't.
You take his calls?
Yeah, I took
you
his
took
calls.
Calls. Okay.
Or sometimes he would just show up in my office and
wow.
Block himself.
Uh-huh.
But you know, but he knew that I, for whatever reason, I just wasn't afraid to be honest with him. So,
uh-huh.
So you know, we kind of had our relationship.
Do you miss it? Do you miss the action? No.
Yeah,
you've done it enough, huh?
No, I have to tell you, I wanted to retire at 62.
Okay.
And my boss, Peter Rice, made me an offer I couldn't refuse, so I hung out for another 3 years. But I never bought into the business. I never bought into the lifestyle. We moved somewhere where our kids could go to public school and know normal people. We
mm-hmm.
associate with normal people. I just, it was always a job for me as opposed to a lifestyle.
Right.
And, that served me well. So I always worked not to work.
Mm-hmm.
So once I felt that, I didn't need to do it anymore, I was out of there so fast, because scheduling is a very stressful job.
Oh, I'm sure it is. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, people, yeah. in the years that I've been retired, there are a lot of people who have said to me, boy, you look a lot better. You seem a lot calmer.
Yeah. Being a professional gambler.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I was in Vegas once. Leno was in Vegas doing his show, and Warren and I got on a plane and flew to Vegas. I called my mother, who lives in Queens, and I said, hey, Mom, I'm in Vegas. You want me to put a bet down or something? She said, oh, why don't you gamble? I go, Mom, I gamble for billions of dollars every year. I said, when I move a show into another slot, that's like putting all, you
yeah,
go all, you're going
you're all
in
there.
You're going
yeah.
all in.
Yeah.
So I was very blessed to work. My bosses have always been great. I really had no complaints about that. And I work with a lot of interesting people and still have a lot of friends in the business. But I have to tell you, whenever I'm heading towards the Fox lot or in that vicinity,
uh-huh.
I still break out in a cold sweat.
Uh-huh.
So I'm happy in what I do now.
Well, thanks so much for keeping Cheers on the air and for moving Frasier.
It.
Yeah, really appreciate it. Thank you, Preston.
Thank you, Ken.
Okay, that will do it. Preston Beckman, by the way, is a daily contributor to TV by the Numbers under his persona of The Masked Scheduler, and he can be followed on Twitter at Masked Scheduler. And I also mention again that he is a media consultant and chairman of the Beckman Group. Our thanks, as always, to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, Randy Thomas, and this week, Preston Beckman. If you want to get hold of me for any reason, I'm easily reachable, HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. That is my email address. I will write you back. HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. And again, I could use a 5-star rating on iTunes. I do not not know why. They keep telling me to plug it, and so I do. Thank you very much in advance. We will talk to you again next week. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.